Which longevity supplements actually work and which ones are very overhyped? This and a lot more I'll be covering in this Q&A episode. If you want to ask me a question, then make sure you follow me on Instagram at Seemland.
It's showtime.
All right, the first question is, name some of the most overhyped longevity supplements that aren't worth it. I think I have probably made at least a few videos about this topic on my channel, not specifically maybe like overhyped, but I have covered like what are the most expensive and like not worth it supplements in terms of the price on the channel. You can look it up on the search. You know, when we're talking about overhyped, then we have to still have to ground it in like evidence. You know, what I consider overhyped would be that people say that it does X or it's like super effective for some things, and in the longevity space it's gonna be that this supplement is gonna, you know, cure aging and make you live a lot longer and the evidence doesn't support that, or there's also some like, yeah, just misinformation about the magnitude of the effect or something else related. So that's what I would consider overhyped. And there are certainly a lot of supplements in this field that could be considered overhyped. You know, starting with resveratrol, you know, NMN and nicotinamide riboside, to a certain extent, they're all overhyped, because when people, you know, are listening to different kinds of, let's say, scientists and longevity influencers on social media, then, yeah, like when they hear about resveratrol or NMN or something like that, then, you know, the reason they start to take it is because they think that it's going to make them live longer and slow down aging. Now, there is no evidence as of now that it's true. Like, we don't have any evidence even in animal studies that resveratrol or NMN or nicotinamide riboside, that it would like extend lifespan, or that it would even slow down the biological aging. Obviously, it's still early with at least NMN and nicotinamide riboside, but it's not early with resveratrol. So resveratrol has been around, you know, even 20 plus years now, and we still don't have the evidence that it would like work directly on lifespan or aging. And in fact, there is a lot of, you know, contrary evidence that it doesn't work even doing that, even in animal studies. Like, human studies are obviously completely different. We don't have almost any longevity supplements proven to work in humans in terms of extending lifespan. Of course, they work in some other ways by extending like healthy biomarkers, or like slowing down some of the hallmarks of aging, which we'll cover later. But in humans, it's obviously very complicated to know which ones actually work. But yeah, like even in animal studies, the resveratrol story is kind of debunked almost, that it can have in humans some effects for like maybe lipid profile or blood sugar management and those kind of things. But it certainly has no, let's say, life extension effects even in animals. And I don't think that it is true in human studies, or in humans. It's not going to pan out that way either. And it's certainly overhyped in terms of that. And I think the hype around resveratrol is declining. It's certainly not as hyped as it was back in the early 2000s when it was first like discovered that, oh my god, these sirtuin activators, etc. You can check out my other video about resveratrol and sirtuins. But yeah, the main short story is that resveratrol doesn't really have like life extension effects even in animals. It might have like some metabolic effects in humans. But yeah, it's definitely one of the most overhyped, and it's certainly not cheap. It's one of the more expensive supplements, and I think the price to benefit ratio for healthy people for these biohackers who are taking resveratrol for life extension, then it's certainly not worth it. And a lot has to do with overhyped, in my opinion. With NMN and nicotinamide riboside, then at least as of now, we don't have either like any life extension or longevity benefits. What we find with NMN and nicotinamide riboside is that they can help with some aspects of, you know, metabolic health and also like hallmarks of aging or like functional decline. So like NMN can affect like walking speed and those kind of things, maybe cognition in the elderly or insulin sensitivity. But, you know, does that characterize, or does that account for actual life extension or longevity? Then, yeah, we don't know. In animals, there are also not no studies showing that it would have those like life extension effects when we're talking about nicotinamide riboside or NMN. So I think they're certainly overhyped, but I do still find value in NAD boosters in certain situations, specifically around circadian rhythm mismatch. If you have some chronic inflammation, if you have, you know, sleep deprivation, where your body would need to have more NAD, or you need to like recover from decline in NAD levels, then I would still find it useful even for healthy individuals to use it as a, like a short-term booster, for lack of a better word. But it doesn't, you know, it's certainly overhyped because people think it's going to do things that it's not proven to do, if that makes sense. It works in certain parameters of health, but it's overhyped because it's not proven to actually have longevity benefits, or it's not proven to have life extension benefits, even in animals, if that makes sense. And I think I'll cap it at this point right now. The three most overhyped would be resveratrol, nicotinamide riboside, and NMN. And as a bonus, I'll maybe mention like spermidine is also pretty overhyped, not because that spermidine itself as a compound wouldn't be good. We have actually quite nice data in human like epidemiological studies and prospective studies that at least dietary spermidine intake is associated with reduced mortality and reduced Alzheimer's and heart disease even, but it's the dietary spermidine, not the supplemental spermidine. And many of these supplement companies might make the leap thinking that just supplementing the spermidine is what is going to mediate those results. But we just don't know that yet. We don't have the same evidence with supplemental spermidine when it comes to the effects of dietary spermidine on health. And, you know, it could also be that just the healthy foods that keep you healthy and help you to reduce your mortality risk, those foods generally also contain spermidine. So even then, you know, it's not specifically proven that spermidine itself as a compound has anti-aging benefits. It might be that just the healthy foods that would make you healthier also contain spermidine. It's almost like a food that contains either protein, carbs, or fats is going to make you live longer. And, you know, all foods contain proteins, carbs, and fats to a certain extent, like in different ratios, obviously. But, you know, just saying that a food has a specific compound is what is going to give you the longevity benefits is too big of a leap, in my opinion. You know, healthy foods contain many different compounds. They contain vitamins and minerals, they contain spermidine, and they contain different kinds of amino acids, etc. And, you know, chances are it can be just the healthy foods that give you those health benefits, not necessarily like a specific compound inside. Or it could also be just the sum of all parts, like all the minerals and all the compounds inside healthy foods is what make them healthy in certain amounts.
This episode is brought to you by Alitura Naturals. Alitura brings you the best natural skincare products for radiating skin and anti-aging. Regular skincare products are full of ingredients and fillers that actually cause more harm than good. Alitura uses only active ingredients sourced and handcrafted in Hawaii. Their products contain zero fillers. The Alitura Night Cream received the 2021 Clean Cert Beauty Awards for Best Face Cream. Alitura also has skin moisturizers, clay mask, serums, and cleansers. Head over to alitura.com and use the code SIIM, S-I-I-M, for a 20% discount.
And the next question is going to be the opposite of this. So like the supplements that actually have evidence, what is like the most evidence-based longevity supplements out there? I recently made an Instagram post about this as well. I listed out my like top five. Obviously, there's the list could be longer. There's maybe a few more of the supplements that you could add there, but in this context I'll just cap it out at five. So the top five are creatine, glycine, NAC, magnesium, and an omega-3 supplement in some form. And of course I've talked a lot about glycine and NAC. Many people aren't surprised about that, and the reason is simple. There's actually quite a lot of human clinical trials showing that the glycine and NAC combo increases glutathione levels, and because of that, it helps to reverse the decline in functional aspects that, you know, happens with aging, like muscle strength, gait speed, cognition, and body composition status. Those things decline with age, and the glutathione increase through GlyNAC helps to reverse that, and it also helps to reverse some of the hallmarks of aging related to like mitochondrial function, telomeres, cell senescence, and those kind of things. So that's, I think, that pretty good. You know, because you don't have that kind of evidence when we're talking about some other supplements. Like, we definitely don't have it with resveratrol or NMN or nicotinamide riboside or even like vitamin C or some other like more older supplements. We don't have that kind of evidence, but we do have it with glycine and NACs, which is why I think it's one of the most evidence-based longevity supplement for humans, at least. You know, whether or not it's going to work in the elderly, like younger people, we don't know that. It probably, you know, your glutathione levels start to decline after the age of 45. So chances are, it's more effective after the age of 45 than before. And, you know, someone in their 20s or 30s probably has little to nothing to gain from at least regular supplementation of GlyNAC. They might benefit from it periodically in certain situations, but they don't need to do it that frequently unless they are experiencing accelerated biological aging or they have some comorbidities like diabetes that reduces glutathione, metabolic syndrome that lowers glutathione, so other kinds of inflammatory conditions that lower the glutathione status. But after the age of 45, when your body, you know, the glutathione decreases and your body is just experiencing this inflammation, as it's called, age-related inflammation, then at that point it's much, I think pretty much a daily thing. I would take like a glycine and NAC combo every day pretty much after the age of 45. Now, creatine is certainly the most evidence-based sports supplement in the world. And because of that, I would suggest that it is, probably like the most evidence-based supplement as a whole. Like, it just has a lot of research benefits specifically around sports performance, muscle strength, muscle power, and, you know, muscle mass as well indirectly, and kind of speed development, those kind of things, anaerobic exercise performance. It comes down, it's like the top one supplement for that by far. And you don't need any fancy like forms of creatine, just a regular creatine monohydrate does the trick. But creatine also has a lot of longevity benefits. Obviously, maintaining muscle and maintaining muscle strength and muscle power is incredibly important for anti-aging and longevity, because, you know, you with age, you do see a decrease in muscle mass and muscle strength, but you specifically, the biggest thing that you lose is type 2 muscle fibers. So the fast twitch muscle fibers, the speed, you lose the speed, which is, you know, a lot more important when we're talking about preventing falls and preventing hip fractures. So if you're falling off the stairs, then your slow twitch muscle fibers aren't going to save you that much. You need to have the fast twitch muscle fibers. You need to have the speed and agility and quickness to grab a hold of yourself and grab a hold of the staircase or something like that to prevent the falls. Creatine also has brain benefits. So there's a lot of creatine in the brain, and your brain uses a lot of creatine to produce ATP, and the, you know, demand for ATP is massive by the brain. Like, your brain, you know, your brain consumes probably the most ATP in relation to its mass. So your brain comprises only, like, you know, less than 5% of your total body weight, but it consumes up to 20% of your total energy per day. So it consumes a lot of ATP, and creatine helps with a lot of, let's say, aspects of cognitive function, as well as it has neuroprotective effects because of that as well. So your brain just maintains better health just by having higher creatine stores. And creatine supplementation has also been shown to pretty much help with aspects of cognitive decline in the elderly, at least. And lastly, creatine indirectly helps with longevity by reducing your sleep demand. And the biggest reason probably has to do with how it affects your brain, creatine stores, and energy production. So if your brain has more creatine stores, then your demand for sleep also is lower, so you can get away with less sleep. Obviously, you do want to sleep as much as you need, but with age, you see a decline in total sleep duration and sleep quality, which is linked to melatonin production and the circadian rhythms, etc. But if you take, you know, creatine, and we have human studies showing that creatine supplementation, especially over a long period of time, reduces the sleep pressure or reduces like sleep demand. And it's also been found in athletes who are experiencing sleep deprivation that the creatine supplementation mitigates against or attenuates the negative side effects of sleep deprivation on performance. So with sleep deprivation, you see a decline in your physical performance, specifically like the fast twitch performance, like the explosive performance. But with creatine supplementation, you can mitigate against that. So that's another, just a, I think, a very simple for the elderly, especially who are sleeping worse, their sleep quality is worse, they sleep shorter, and they're also more susceptible to cognitive decline and neurodegeneration. Then creatine is like a nootropic or like a brain health supplement first and foremost. Obviously, it has a lot of these physical performance benefits, which are just a bonus, I think. But for longevity purposes, then the biggest, I think the biggest reason I would take creatine as an elderly person for longevity purposes would be the brain benefits and the sleep. Next supplement that I cover is going to be magnesium. So obviously, many people know the importance of magnesium. I call it the master mineral. It governs pretty much every function, every process inside the body. You need magnesium for energy production. You need magnesium for virtually every other process inside the body. And we have a lot of data suggesting that, you know, first of all, dietary magnesium intake is associated with reduced heart disease and reduced mortality. But we also find that magnesium status is like linearly associated with atherosclerosis. So the lower your magnesium status, then the greater burden of atherosclerosis there generally is. And the higher magnesium status, then the lower that burden. So obviously, making sure that you eat plenty of foods that contain magnesium is the starter point. Pumpkin seeds, seafood, fish, leafy greens, almonds, nuts, whatever kind of other seeds and things like that. But the issue is that most of the foods are very depleted of magnesium because the soil is depleted of magnesium. And certain food processing, etc., can also reduce the magnesium content. So a lot of people are magnesium deficient, and it's hard to find magnesium from foods because of the same reasons that I just mentioned. You know, first of all, how many people eat pumpkin seeds on a regular basis? You could maybe get a lot of magnesium from, like, if you eat oysters every day or something like that. But again, it's gotta be hard to, like, reach the optimal intake of magnesium. And sometimes your magnesium requirement could be a lot higher than the RDA. So the RDA is 420 milligrams. But let's say in a state of higher inflammation, higher stress, which a lot of people are, and a lot of things that deplete your magnesium, like high blood sugar levels, you know, cortisol levels, even like circadian rhythm mismatch, artificial light exposure, all those things that increase oxidative stress and inflammation in the body, or reduce your sleep quality, all those things just increase your magnesium demand. And chances are most people would actually benefit from a magnesium intake of like 600 or 700 milligrams per day. If you have some sort of a chronic disease like diabetes or hyperinsulinemia or hyperglycemia, then even 1,000 milligrams could be, you know, worthwhile. So that's why I think magnesium supplement is such a simple and easy win. You gained a lot of benefits and it's very safe. It's been, you know, repeatedly shown to have benefits, the magnesium status per se, and reducing like the risk of incident cardiovascular disease and those kind of things. So I think it's just such a simple win with a huge upside. Like, you gain a lot of, you know, the best or the, you know, the least you could, or the smallest things you could benefit from by taking a magnesium would be like better sleep or lower stress. And if you are someone who experiences those kind of things, then, you know, why not take like a magnesium. And the last supplement that I'll mention is omega-3s. Obviously, you know, fish oil or supplementing fish oil is one of those things even like everyone's grandma knows or they've heard that supplementing fish oil is good for heart health and reducing the risk of cardiovascular disease, which, you know, in the totality of evidence is true. Like, there are some studies finding that there is no effect in supplementing fish oil or omega-3s in reducing risk of heart disease, but the totality of evidence suggests that yes, it does. And the omega-3s, specifically EPA and DHA, have a lot of health benefits in terms of lowering like inflammation, lowering oxidative stress, having insulin sensitizing effects, and those kind of things. So if you just look at the totality of evidence, then it does suggest that, you know, I mean, there's just so many trials repeatedly since, I don't know, like the 80s and 90s, showing that, yes, the, you know, in whatever form the omega-3s come from, whether that be fish oil or like cod liver oil or something like that, that the omega-3s, you want to just get a sufficient amount of EPA and DHA into your system every day. And that amount generally falls around, you know, 1.5 to 3 grams of EPA, DHA combined per day is what generally is the amount associated with the reduced mortality. And what you also find is that people with the highest EPA and DHA levels in the blood have a significantly lower risk of heart disease, significantly lower risk of all-cause mortality, and Alzheimer's disease and dementia as well. All right, next question. Is there an optimal time to train, like after eating, after walking, after waking up, or something like that? Yes, there is, you know, if you were to live in a perfect world where you can always control your daily routine and your schedule, then, you know, at least depends on the type of training. So what we do know is that strength and power peak in the afternoon from a circadian rhythm standpoint. So you are stronger and more explosive around 4 to 5 p.m. in the afternoon than you are in the morning. So if you are some sort of a person who does powerlifting or weightlifting, or you just want to hit larger numbers at the gym and you really want to optimize it, then yes, the best time to train would be around, you know, 3, 4, 5 p.m., something like that. Now, if you're the person who can't control the schedule, then the best time to train for whatever type of training it is, then it's obviously at any time you can. I would, you know, always be careful with working out in the middle of the night or too late in the evening, because, you know, if you mess up your sleep and you mess up your circadian rhythms, then I think, you know, it might not be that worth it. Like, I would wait for the weekend when you're free from work or something like that, and then have a workout at the optimal time, rather than to like really think that you need to work out every day, even if I'm working out at midnight and I'm going to bed at 1 a.m. or something like that. So I think if you can choose, then work out for strength purposes in the afternoon. If you are doing cardio, then you can work out pretty much at any time. I wouldn't do cardio maybe like 5 hours before bed, because if you raise your heart rate too much, then it can disrupt sleep quality. And the same applies to like HIIT cardio, stuff like that. Don't do like any super intense form of exercise at least 4 to 5 hours before bed. Cardio is fine if you do it in the morning, because it's good for actually kickstarting the circadian rhythm and increasing this NAD recycling in the morning, which is a great thing for the circadian rhythms and overall like metabolism. But for strength training, then you are stronger, yes, in the afternoon. And kind of definitely I wouldn't do like very intense heavy strength training like in the morning. Like, you might actually be at a higher risk of injuries if you are like immediately after waking up you're going to hit the gym for some heavy weights. Like, of course it's better than nothing, but if you can choose, then yeah, the best time to do so in the afternoon. Now, in terms of the meal timing, then I do think that working out after food is slightly superior, at least for strength and maximum power. So if you are doing cardio, then you don't need to eat. But if you are, you know, doing some sort of a weightlifting or powerlifting type workout, then you are always going to be more stronger after eating. You know, I've worked out fasted hundreds of times. I've done strict 1 minute a day where I work out and then I eat. But it was never as effective for muscle growth or strength development as the method that I'm doing now, which is I call the targeted intermittent fasting. So I have a protein shake, and then I work out, and then I have the food after the workout. So that's a much more effective way, because you're going to have more amino acids in your bloodstream. So those amino acids reduce your muscle catabolism. So you build more muscle as a result of that, and you're probably also stronger because of just having more energy from that. You could also eat like some simple carbohydrates before the workout, but I wouldn't have like a massive meal immediately before the workout. So like, I wouldn't eat like burgers and fries. I wouldn't eat like massive pasta, or even like a massive steak is probably too heavy for the workout immediately. If I were to, you know, eat something immediately before a workout, then I would stick to something very easy to digest, like either eggs, cook some eggs, maybe fish is even fine, but like a protein shake or something. Whey protein is the most bioavailable, the fastest absorbing, fastest digesting protein in the world. And yeah, I just slam a protein shake, whey protein, and then I'll be able to work out pretty much in, you know, less than an hour, 30 minutes, even like in 5 minutes if I want to. All right, next question. We know that plastic in the kitchen is generally not healthy for cooking purposes. What are some other like ingredients that we need to be careful with? So yes, plastic, I would like not really use plastic for almost anything. I would certainly not use plastic to microwave things, not use plastic to put like hot or warm liquids or warm food in. The only safe thing that you can use plastic is like storing cold food in. And even then, you know, it's not the most optimal, but I wouldn't like really freak out about that. So if you store like some sort of leftovers, you can store them in a plastic container in the fridge, but don't like heat up the plastic container when you are about to eat it. Or if you are like trying to warm it up, you would put it into like a stainless steel pot or ceramic pot or a pan or something like that before you eat it. But you know, if you can choose, then obviously the BPA free versions of plastic are a bit better than with BPA. But even then, BPA free means that they just have something else that you know, the marketing hasn't caught up with. Most people are careful with BPA because the kind of social awareness around BPA has reached a boiling point where the marketers of these companies are, okay, they know that BPA is bad, so we're going to replace it with something else. So we say BPA free, but we have, you know, BPS or BPY, whatever other, because, you know, there's hundreds of these different chemicals. They just put BPA instead of BPA, they'll have BPR, BPP, whatever. And it's as bad. It's just that people don't know that it's bad. So they think it's BPA free and think it's fine, but it has the other compounds that are equally as bad. So with that being said, I wouldn't use VR plastic for anything that is liquid and warm and hot. Cold is, you know, kind of fine, but again, it's not the most optimal. What you could use is like glass. Glass is the kind of safest alternative, or stainless steel. That's another, or ceramic. So that's kind of the safest materials. When it comes to other dangerous, let's say, compounds on the cookingware, then like Teflon that is used to coat the frying pans with, that also contains the xenoestrogens. And if you obviously, when you're using a frying pan, then you're gonna use high temperatures that mobilize those xenoestrogens into your food. So Teflon is another one of those compounds that I wouldn't use for frying pans. Out of the non-stick pans, then like a stainless steel or a ceramic pan is again the most optimal method. I wouldn't use like a cast iron steel pan either, because the cast iron steel is just going to leach the iron into your food. So you might be getting too much iron in that scenario as well. Maybe if you're anemic, it's fine, but most people, especially men, aren't. So for them, it actually increases the risk of heart disease, in my opinion. Like excess iron exposure is not good. So cast iron pans aren't healthy either. The healthiest frying pans are, yeah, like stainless steel or the ceramic pans. So overall, stay away from all things that contain plastic, and ideally also be wary of the non-stick, pans or whatever, like the spatula or something like that, that can also be made of like some sort of silicon or something. It's better than plastic, obviously, but if you can use like a wooden spatula or some sort of iron spatula, stainless steel spatula again, which is much more like safer ingredient. And the same actually like cutting boards. That's something that I also recently learned, that the cutting boards, if they're made of plastic, then, you know, if you're cutting with a knife, then you're actually cutting into the cutting board and you're cutting into the plastic. So that also, like, you know, you're pretty much exposing your food to those microplastics, and you might actually like eat the same microplastics if you actually accidentally put it into your salad or something like that. So the best cutting board again is also wooden cutting board. So wooden is actually, you know, it's the safest kind of ingredient. Next question, I've got an energy drink problem. Is that really bad for your health? Well, you know, when you look at the ingredients on energy drinks, whatever, Monster or something like that, then, you know, most of the ingredients, they look nice, like B6 or niacin and other kinds of vitamins and stuff like that. And, you know, you would say that, okay, these vitamins and stuff like that are healthy for me. You know, yes and no. I mean, technically, the only harm of energy drinks just comes from the high amounts of caffeine. So one energy drink, like one Monster, has around like 150 milligrams of caffeine. You know, the Nocco, which is the smaller, like a more fitness brand, it's a smaller bottle, but it contains 180 milligrams of caffeine, which is a lot more. And I think, you know, the safe amount of caffeine per day for an adult is generally around, you know, 200, I think, is a kind of a safe dose, and up to like 400 milligrams is also fine. But again, you're kind of starting to push the envelope a little bit, and your sleep quality will probably suffer if you get like 400 milligrams every day. So technically, if you drink like one energy drink that contains 150 milligrams of caffeine, then it's not going to be unhealthy, quote unquote. It's just going to pretty much increase your caffeine levels in the blood that can disrupt your sleep quality. And some people are also more sensitive to that. They can get jittery. There's nothing inherently bad about that, except for the high amounts of caffeine. Like, of course, younger individuals and some people can overdose on caffeine, especially if they take powdered caffeine. So that's why I'm not a fan of powdered pre-workouts, because they just contain so much caffeine, and you can easily overdose on that without being careful. But with energy drinks, you still have to drink a lot of them. And unless you're literally addicted to energy drinks, that you're drinking 4 to 5 cans a day, then it's not going to like harm your health, granted that everything else is in check. And of course, if the energy drink contains sugar, then that's a kind of a different story. Like the Noccos, those are sugar-free. They're sugar-free monsters as well. But if you're getting the regular monster that contains the sugar as well, then that's unhealthy, yeah, because of the sugar. The caffeine itself isn't that unhealthy in moderation. Yeah, people have different feelings about caffeine. But if you look at the data, then caffeine alone in small amounts, 100 to 200 milligrams a day, there's no data that it's harmful or that it would like be unhealthy. And actually, if you look at the data, then, you know, coffee consumption, 2 to 3 cups of coffee a day is actually associated with a significantly lower risk of all-cause mortality and lower risk of heart disease and lower risk of liver cancer and those things. With coffee, it's obviously because of the polyphenols and the antioxidants inside the coffee. But some of the effects might be mediated by the caffeine as well. So again, the sugar energy drinks are bad. If you drink like 1 to 2, maybe I wouldn't drink any more than like 1. At least personally, I wouldn't want to consume any more than 200 milligrams of caffeine per day. But if it's below that, then I don't see any reason why it would be like harmful. You know, it's caffeine, and you know, caffeine can have different effects in different people. Depends how you react and how you use it. Like if you drink like an energy drink before a workout and you have a good workout, then it's like it might be a net positive because you're, you know, getting more gains and more results at the gym by increasing your energy and alertness with the caffeine. All right, next question. What is the optimal amount of cardio? So cardio, I think, is underrated for sure. Like many people in like longevity and the biohacking world, they're almost like neglecting cardio and they're just doing weightlifting and stuff like that. You obviously want to do both, but if you look at the effect in risk reduction or the size of risk reduction, then cardio, or at least moderate exercise, outperforms vigorous exercise, and having higher cardio respiratory fitness alone outperforms having high muscle strength alone in terms of reducing all-cause mortality risk. So cardio is more effective in reducing heart disease risk and all-cause mortality risk. But if you combine them together, then you see a greater reduction, if that makes sense. It's just that the cardio is giving most of the results, or a significantly higher proportion of those results. How much is too much? You know, technically, I would even suggest that at least in the short term, even overtraining with cardio probably isn't going to be bad, like at least in the short term. Yes, you might lose some sleep. Yes, you know, you might start to get some injuries or stuff like that. But in terms of your biomarkers, all the biomarkers would generally improve if you're doing like a lot of cardio. The only thing that might increase is some of those DNA methylation patterns. So what we do know from at least my own experience, as well as some studies, that overtraining or excessive exercise, whether that be weightlifting or cardio, then that can accelerate the markers of biological aging. Now, whether or not it actually reflects actual biological aging or the speed of your biological aging is not clear, or at least there's no evidence that those clocks would actually, you know, predict your mortality or your speed of aging. They just measure certain things. And we know that overexercising accelerates those clocks, if that makes sense. But fortunately, we do have, like, you know, some studies, meta-analysis, finding that even up to 800 minutes per week of moderate exercise, which includes zone 2 cardio and hiking and walking and anything that is not vigorous and anaerobic, then even up to 800 minutes per day still gives you a reduction in heart disease and all-cause mortality risk compared to getting 200 minutes per week. So it's a linear reduction in the risk. So the more moderate physical activity you do per week, the lower your risk of all-cause mortality and heart disease, at least based on recent studies and meta-analysis that we have. But the same isn't true with vigorous physical activity, so weightlifting or anaerobic cardio. So with that kind of exercise, you see a more like a J or U-shaped curve, with zero amounts of vigorous activity being bad, but excess amounts of vigorous activity also being associated with increased risk. So somewhere in the middle, like, and with weightlifting, it's generally around like 60 to 80 minutes per week, maybe up to 140 minutes at max. and with vigorous exercise, which would probably include weightlifting plus high intensity exercise, high intensity cardio, then it's going to be also somewhere around like 150 minutes or 200 minutes at most per week. But there is no similar linear reduction the same way with moderate exercise. So, you know, if you're doing 800 minutes of intense exercise per week, then you are probably increasing your risk because of overtraining. But doing zone 2 cardio or other forms of moderate physical activity up to 800, I haven't seen data about 1,000 minutes per week, but I would presume that it still follows a similar trend, that even 1,000 minutes per week of moderate physical activity, like hiking, walking, and zone 2 cardio output here as well, that even then you would probably see a reduction in the benefits. So what's the optimal amount is, you know, how much you can do almost, or how serious are you in terms of reducing your risk. If you are really gung-ho or, you know, super motivated to reduce your risk as much as possible, then yes, like 800 minutes per week apparently is the best in terms of reducing the risk. Do you need to do 800 minutes per week? You know, hard to say. You have to also look at other factors, how it's going to affect your sleep, how it's going to affect your, you know, stress levels and those kind of things, and your biomarkers. Like, people react differently to exercise, or, you know, their biomarkers might react differently, at least in the extremes of exercise. But generally, your biomarkers will improve. It's just that, you know, at what point are you reaching the point of diminishing returns? At what point are you causing more inflammation and causing more oxidative stress with the overtraining? So I need to kind of find out, okay, how much can I do? And how much is my kind of point of diminishing returns? Me personally, you know, I do try to do at least 2 to 3 workouts of zone 2 cardio per week, which generally involves like 30 to 45 minutes of zone 2 cardio. But obviously I walk every day as well, so I'll walk every day at least 1 to 2 hours. I have like the standing work desk and the walking treadmill, so I'll be able to work while I'm walking, but obviously I walk outside as well, go for walks in the park and stuff like that. So I'll be getting, you know, per week, if I were to guess, I would get at least 600 or 500 to 600 minutes per week of moderate physical activity. And with intense physical activity, I'll be getting like 3 45-minute weightlifting workouts per week and maybe like a 20-minute high-intensity cardio session per week. So that's in total going to be 150 minutes per week, something like that, of vigorous physical activity. And I think that's a pretty good starting point, at least based on the evidence, that you don't want to overdo intense exercise, but you can certainly you can still do a lot of moderate physical exercise. You can do hundreds of hours of moderate physical activity per week and still see benefits in risk reduction. All right, that's it for this video. If you want to ask me a question in the future, then make sure you follow me on Instagram @seemlund. But do you want to slow down aging and live longer? If yes, then I'm looking for more people who want to reverse their biological clock. If you're interested, then email me the word health to info@seemlund.com and I'll send you the details.